Hi, Jason. I'm Jesse Ossibel, Director of the Program for the Human Environment at the Rockefeller University.
Thank you for joining the program here today. Appreciate it. And for me, this is one of those rock stars of the research world. I've been citing him in my presentations for, at least 10 years now, I want to say. A study about decarbonization since the days when Abraham Lincoln was around, and we'll talk about that, as well as maybe if we can get into environmental DNA, eDNA. That's a new word I was not familiar with, but we're going to start with peak humans, which, Mr. Ossibel, I gotta ask you, is this kind of a twist and a spin on peak oil? Because that's where my mind went right away.
It is indeed. Peak oil, peak stuff, peak use of materials, peak farmland, maybe. And I and my colleagues had worked on all of those questions over the last few decades. And about 8-10 years ago, we started asking ourselves, well, what about peak human and peak humans? You know, if you think about cars or drill bits and pipes, you know, you could say, well, in 1910, you have a car, the 1930 model is going to be superior in performance, the 1950 model, the 1970 model, the 1990 model. It may not be more beautifully from an aesthetic point of view, but it'll have a lot of features, longevity and so forth, that are better. Again, the same would be said about most of the things that we work with, computers, light bulbs, whatever. You expect over time, they'll get better. And so we decided to use the techniques that we've used to study the history of technology to look at us, to look at people, to look at Homo sapiens, to look at humans and ask, well, you know, if you took the average human in the year 1700 or 1800 and then 1850, 1900, 1950, 2000, and the 2022 or the 2023 model, what's happening? Are they getting better?
That's interesting. So are we talking about like humanity? We're talking ethics. Are we talking about health? Which mind, body, soul, the trilogy? I mean, what when you talk about humans, what's the quick definition of that?
Well, we're talking both about the individual and the collectivity, all of us.
Yeah.
And we've looked at four different dimensions. There might be other dimensions that people would be interested in too, but we've looked at four. The first one, we can go into all of these in more detail, but first let me just mention the quartet. One is peak physical performance. Think of the Olympics, you know, how high someone can jump, how fast someone can run, how fast they can swim. Then the second dimension we call lifetime performance, how long you live, how good is your eyesight, how tall are you. The third dimension is cognitive. Your IQ or your educational attainment, your literacy, so mostly brain kinds of things. And the fourth dimension is immune system education. Do you get asthma and allergies? Are you prone to infection and disease? So we set up that framework, and we're interested in all the different ways that you could affect peak performance from better training, better sneakers, drugs. Obviously, in sports, drugs became really famous. So we are open to all the different ways. Who mating your spouse? You know partly it could be genetic. So we're open to all the different dimensions that people could use, including some that are illegal or frowned upon, to improve performance in these four ways.
It's a very interesting thesis, or I guess just a thought to look at humanity from an individual and also from a collective society. Have we peaked? I've heard a lot of different angles, whether it be population control or there's other conspiracies and other scientific researches. What type of response are you getting in this type of progressive and thought-provoking research? Is it more on the conspiratorial side, or is it more on the population control, or is it more on just, whoa, what's going on here?
Well, it's a new idea. I don't think anybody else has really done this before.
No, I haven't seen it.
is just sort of shock and surprise. Mm-hmm. And maybe I should summarize for you a little bit of what we've learned, and then we can talk a little bit about the implications and how different cultures, what people on the political spectrum might view this. Basically, what we found is that, let's say from 1700 or 1800, for 200, 250 years, humanity, for the most part, has had an incredible run. So if you think of your parents or your grandparents or your great-grandparents or great-great-grandparents, in general, you're going to be better in these four dimensions than they were. So if you think again of the Olympics, every 4 years, the Olympics have happened since about 1900, and lots of records were broken each time. Maybe because the pool of people participating grew, maybe because people had better training, maybe because they were taking drugs, maybe because they had a better pole vaulting pole. But basically, in this physical dimensions, people have just been getting better and better. And it could be swimming, or it could be the marathon running, it could be golf. People are driving golf balls much further, partly because they have better training and better coaching, partly because they have better clubs, partly because of the change in the golf ball. So we found that there was this big run in physical performance, but in the last decade or two, it's been getting harder to win the increments. So we sort of had this big run-up of improvements, let's say from 1750, 1800 to 2000. And we found the same with the lifetime performance, these things like longevity. You know, again, if you think, did people live 50 years or 60 years or 70 years or 80 years? How tall were they? You know, if you look at uniforms of soldiers from the time of Napoleon or the Civil War, the uniforms are small and the shoes are small. People were smaller. So because of diet, because of nutrition, a whole bunch of things, again, for 200 years or so, people were living longer, in general, having a longer, healthy lifespan, and getting bigger and larger and more potent in some sense. And even that was true on the cognitive side. There's a famous thing called the Flynn effect, a pretty famous thing, about IQs growing all over the world during the 20th century. And of course, more and more people became literate, more and more people went to secondary school and then college. And so generally people have become, you'll say, smarter, better educated too. And on the immune system, we started to see a bit of a shift earlier. It turns out that, I'll say, playing in the mud, like Amish kids do, is good for your immune system, having contact with animals. But, of course, people were using things to sort of fake or rehearse immune system education, things like vaccinations. It's pretty clear in recent decades, people have been getting more asthma and allergies because of lifestyles in cities and other kinds of things. And in general, so what we found is that after this 200-year run of general people getting stronger, living longer, being better educated, it's been harder and harder to win gains. And in these last 20, 30 years, it's been offset a lot by losses. So people have more asthma and allergies. Life expectancy has actually been falling a bit. First, because of opioids and substance abuse in the U.S., and also a bit because of COVID. And educational attainment seems to have plateaued, too. You know, it's not clear that actually with what's going on, you know, people may go to college, it's not so clear they're learning more. And even at the Olympics, again, fewer records are being broken. So we asked ourselves, well, maybe you know, this basic model of the Homo sapiens, maybe we're getting most of what we can out of it. There was a lot of undeveloped potential in 1800 or even 1900 or 1950, but maybe we're getting, you know, most of what we can. Let's not say everything, but a lot. And a lot of what we're doing to squeeze out those last few extra bits have offsetting problems. I mean, if again, you think of steroids or things that help people to hit home runs or whatever, but they have other health consequences which may be damaging, offsetting. So in the big picture, we think it's plausible that maybe we're pretty near peak human.
When you say peak human, the very basic is just like how it sounds, meaning that we've peaked and we're starting to decline. Is that right? Just as the four pillars you talked about, and also as a society. That's, I'm following you so far, correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe we'll stay on a plateau.
Right. But the signs are there.
A little bit better, but I think all these easy gains that we've had for a long time, most of those have probably been won or earned.
Mm-hmm.
And we could start down, and in some areas we are starting down. A big example of that is obesity. You know, there are about 1 billion obese people in the sure. world now, and it's a real problem for longevity. You don't live as long. You're more susceptible to diabetes and a lot of other illnesses. So there could be, I mentioned also the asthma and allergies, where the lack of contact with, I'll say, with the land, with dirt, and with dogs and cats and horses, it may be that we're actually not educating our immune systems as well as people in cities, as people in rural mm-hmm. areas did. So it could be that in some areas we're starting down. And of course, the machines are getting smarter. You know, your listeners, you think about horsepower. You think of what happened with horsepower. You know, people wanted to compete. You know, Paul Bunyan types, with saws, wanted to compete with electric saws for a long time.
Yeah.
And, you know, but by 1900, 1950, people had given up and realized that when it came to raw power, you know, if you wanted to dig a ditch or, you know, you were better off getting a bobcat or some kind of mechanical device than getting 10 or 100 people or trying to bulk up the people you had.
Mm-hmm.
And so now in the 21st century, we all talk about artificial intelligence and machine learning. Maybe we're seeing the same kind of thing that happened with horsepower, let's say in 1850, 1900, 1950. So, you know, we were overtaken. You know, humans and horses and oxen are just overtaken by, you know, by John Deere and Caterpillar and Boeing and aircraft. And, you know, maybe that's now what's happening on the cognitive side, too. So, you know, that the machines will keep getting smarter, but, you know, maybe we'll stay around the same level of high school or college education that we now have.
Boy, this is what I wish I still had my hour-long show at night, where we could really unpack some of these different topics, because back in 2009, when I was doing Nighttime Live, we would talk about some of these things, but the direction that we kind of talked about wasn't so much the peak human. It was, it always started with humans and tools. It just seems like no matter what the tool is, it allows humans to become faster who they are. It allows people to see who they are. It allows us to be quicker with things. The bicycle, of course, is another example. Fire. Humans seem to always need tools in order to get to that next step. Well, then we go into where we're at with computers and the internet and artificial intelligence. And of course, this was back in 2009 and some of the early days. But Israel they had honey or drones the size of honeybees back in 2008, 2009. So this wasn't science fiction. This was real. And we started talking about the thought worker. How are we going to take care of the thought worker in this new world that we live in? Because the tangible tire market is being replaced by the intangible Facebook market. And the granite and the marble and the brick that the government used to build buildings with to show the symbolism that they're going to stick around and they're not going anywhere, boy, that's like being replaced by poor grammar and just unprofessional behavior in the intangible workplace. And so how much of this is that intangible, tangible thought worker part? Because a lot of this seems to be very like socially policy driven. Did you follow me on that? Because there was a lot in that. I apologize.
Yeah, no. It's a very interesting line of discussion. I would say a keyword is motivation. You know, mm-hmm. This is why you have to look at things like the obesity question. You know, a lot of people are still very fit and go to the gym and are healthy and lead active lives, but a lot of people don't. And the same kind of questions arrive with the service economy and all these cognitive brain kinds of things. You know, people could just be very passive, you know, like that was the movie WALL-E. You know, we could all sort of become couch potatoes, or maybe, you know, we'll really try hard. And that's, it's a wide open question for the next century, you know, whether in that sense we'll just sort of sit around and let the machines, the drones, deliver, you know, burgers and shakes to us, or whether, or what fraction of the human population will continue to have some real drive. So I'd say, you know, motivation is the final frontier in that sense, both on the physical side and on the intellectual side. Now, what one interesting thing that's happened, and we touched on this at the very beginning, you know, there's the collective thing. You know, what about our species as a whole, or America as a whole? And 2012 seems to have been the year of peak baby, like peak oil. Peak oil mm-hmm. probably hasn't happened. Even peak coal probably hasn't happened. But peak baby does seem to have happened. There were about 140 million babies born in the year 2012, and it's been going down since then. And, you know, the birth rates all over the world are falling. So people, whether it's narcissism or hedonism or fear of the future, you know, we seem not to be growing in that way anymore. And even the world's leading demographers now think, you know, we're at whatever, you know, 8 billion people now. 9 billion will probably peak at something like 9.5, maybe 10. But so we've had peak baby, and peak humans may not be so far away in the future. So that relates to what you're saying too, where, you know, the whole view and how people live, you know, may change in terms of, you know, what their motivations are. And so, you know, it's this whole question of what the 21st century will be like. It really could be very different from these last 200, 250 years where we've had all these kinds of growth and development. That's not to say we may in many ways be very rich and very well served, very comfortable, but it may be a very different type of development, as you were saying, in this century than what we've had in the last 200, 250 years.
It's a very interesting conversation, because the one I had yesterday was 100% about artificial intelligence. I was I was guest hosting for a gentleman in Bismarck, North Dakota, for his Talk of the Town radio show, morning radio show. And we had on a gentleman, Marlo Anderson, who does the National Day calendar, but also is the founder of the Tech Ranch. And we got into a real interesting conversation about artificial intelligence, how this is really going to be the springboard year. This is when it's going to start to take off. And so last night, I actually subscribe to an artificial intelligence piece of software, and in 20 minutes, I wrote 5 children's books. I got them done. I edited them, and I'm not going to do anything with them. This was just some research to see how easily things are done. But what Marlo and I talked about was you brought up a great point with the horse and buggy being replaced by the John Deere's and the Caterpillars. The example that I always give people is the magic amulet when penicillin came. There's a lot of people that, hey, they hung on to that magic amulet and leeches for a long time, but penicillin eventually won out, just like eventually the John Deere and the Caterpillars won out versus the, you can't have a good piece of lumber unless it's cut by hand. There was a lot of people that thought that for a while, you know, like you said, they resisted the chainsaws and the power sawmills, but eventually the shift happens. What kind of shift are we looking at here? Because we're talking about artificial intelligence taking over thought working now. We're talking about writers being replaced by artificial intelligence. And that old saying goes, if you're one in a million, there's like 1,000 of you in China. So what kind of shift are we looking at here? Globally.
Well, I think it's a big shift. And increasingly, the machines will be able to write music, create art, create children's books, do mathematics. And so one has to wonder about the future of work. And, you know, there could still be a lot of, personal jobs as, you know, as personal trainers or in healthcare and allied healthcare, but it really may be that a lot of the work that the high-end labor markets have dominated on the cognitive side, that there's going to be a lot of competition. I would say in the long run, however, you want to either own machines or know how to program them. I think those people will be pretty insulated. If you're rich enough to own a bunch of machines, like as was true for owning horses, or if you have the special skills to do the coding and the programming, those groups will be pretty insulated. But that may only be a few percent of the, you know, of the whatever 9 billion mm-hmm. people on the planet. So, we want to keep people happy and entertained, and you can do that in a lot of ways with the. With the soccer World Cup or pro football or whatever, but you also want people to be fulfilled in other ways. So it's important that there's a lot of thinking needs to go into what will make up a good life in the future. Part of that, I personally think very much is still being out in nature. The people sometimes joke about what's called nature deficit disorder, that we don't get enough exposure, people in cities especially. But I think beauty is incredibly important for people. Beauty relaxes people. And just going for a walk under the big sky or looking at the ocean, there are a lot of experiences like that that continue to be really important for people.
I've said for a while there's a market in humanity. And you talk about peak human, and yesterday Marlo and I talked about how there's probably going to be a market for people that want to experience 100% real things. Like they'll go and all weekend long, everything's 100% real, just so they feel safe and they know what's real and they're looking at and that type of thing. When you talk about peak human, what are we looking at for the market place here? Because at the end of the day, we still have some sort of bartering system. We still have some sort of economy, some sort of society. Everything from capitalism supposed to go away to is there a soft fascism being ushered in to is it socialism? What are we looking at for the economy going forward?
Some of what you're mentioning is not really my area of expertise.
Okay.
But you're mentioning Marlo and tourism, I'll say that's a really important area and a very interesting one. If you think about the experiences that people want to have, whether it's going to Yellowstone and Yosemite or mm-hmm. going to the city of Venice or Paris, with 9 billion people, not everybody can go to Yellowstone. It degrades the experience. There are also pollution problems, but the same would be true of Paris. And places like the very popular tourist places, traditional tourist places, let's say like Paris or Venice, maybe they have 10 million tourists a year. But Disney World, Orlando, already has something like 60 or 70 million because it's been created as a machine to give people those experiences.
Mm-hmm.
But even those places can't cope, if every person in India or China or Indonesia wants to do that, you'll just destroy, you'll kill the goose that laid the golden egg. So this is where augmented reality and virtual reality come in. Everybody can have a pair of goggles. All 9 billion people can have a pair of goggles and experience virtual Venice or virtual Paris or, the virtual Super Bowl. So I think a lot of what will happen in the future is, in this sense, I think Facebook Meta is right. A lot of what's going to happen during the century is providing virtual experiences to people because, you can't send 9 billion people to Yellowstone or the Black Hills or take your pick, the North Pole or the South Pole. So I think there's a necessity if we want to If we want to give lots of people access to experiences, a lot of them will have to be virtual. So for a lot of people, I think a lot of life will be sort of like a cruise ship. You sort of get on this trip, so to say, for a week with 5,000 other people in your goggles, and you know, you'll have lots of nice food and you'll see all kinds of things. And you may do it together in a way that also provides some more satisfaction. But as we were saying earlier, I think people are still going to want authentic experiences also. So that, you know, it'll be some mix. You know, I don't know whether it'll be 80-20 or whatever, but you know, the economy will have to provide both. In order to satisfy the 9 or 10 billion, we'll have to provide a lot of virtual experiences. But to, so to say, to make life real still, you know, there are going to have to be these authentic experiences. And certain things like whatever, kindergarten education, you know, I think we've seen from COVID, the remote stuff just doesn't work that well. So, you know, early childhood education, you know, there are some things that so far it just doesn't seem that the synthetic versions are very effective. So there'll still have to be a lot of services provided for young people and particular groups, which are, I'll say, quite traditional.
Yeah. Yeah, I see where the marketplace is going to change in a lot of different directions, from the meta marketplace that you're referring to. I mean, we've got Second Life has been around for a while, to where people, they do business deals virtually. And then there's also the meta side of things and the virtual reality. And then you got the whole other side of it too. This is going to be a very interesting, and just from the artificial intelligence side, just the legal practice, that industry is going to evolve completely, where attorneys who used to do like wills, say, for example, that's going to be replaced by an artificial intelligent person in the next couple of years, to where you'll probably see them in kiosks at the mall next to pretzel maker. And then the attorneys will have a whole other AI lawsuits coming up. So that I see their market changing quite a bit too. So I did want to ask too about the last 150 years, that fact that I used to cite. I used to cite your name behind that from the Rockefeller University, where we've been decarbonizing as a planet for the last 150 years. But that was a number of years ago that I found that piece of research. Do you have time to just talk about that a little bit? Explain.
Happy to talk about that.
Yeah, explain that a little bit. Does that play into this at all? Because I would think that, you know, our energy would have a lot to do with our life expectancy.
Yeah, the energy system is incredibly important for health, longevity, all these kinds of things. Yeah, back in the 1980s, together with some colleagues, an Italian named Marchetti, two Austrians named Nakachinovich and Grubler, I think we were actually the very first people to use the term decarbonization and publish it. Now everybody uses it. We don't get cited for having, let's say, invented it or defined it, but we were using it a lot by the late 80s. And what we came upon decarbonization in the following way. We said, well, suppose you just had this big blender and you put all the fuels, all the hay, all the coal, all the oil, all the gas that you're using into a big blender and made a mix from, let's say, from 1700 to the present. What would the average fuel look like? And what would the ratio of carbon and hydrogen atoms be? And of course, you know, if you're dealing with cellulose or something, let's say you have 10 C's for 1 H. If you're dealing with coal, you have 1 C and 1 H. If you have oil, like kerosene, you have CH2, let's say 1 C and 2 H's, methane and CH4. So what we found is that over a long period of time, the average blend was shifting from C to H. It was decarbonizing. The H's were very gradually winning. And it was a very steady monotonic trend for the data sets that we could find from 1800 up into the 1980s. The last 30 years or so, it's kind of plateaued in a lot of places. And the big reason we think is that nuclear energy, the advance of nuclear energy was slowed over what was expected. There's a lot of talk about solar and wind, which also decarbonize, but of course don't produce many kilowatt hours. But we think now with the resumption of growth by nuclear energy, potentially by solar and wind. I think they're going to disappoint most people, but the decarbonization is resuming. Although in the very short run, of coal, of course, coal had a good year last year because of all the troubles in Europe. But so we think this that the H's will gradually win, and it may take till 2060, 2070, 2080 before the sort of reference fuel, instead of being kerosene or methane, will be something that's close to pure hydrogen. So there's this very long trend. And of course, the trend from C to H is good in a lot of ways. It's certainly from an environmental point of view, it's much cleaner. But it has lots of implications for end-use devices. And of course, each of the C fuels, coal, I'll say A and biomass, as well as coal, oil, and gas, has had tremendous, wonderful features. I published a piece a few years ago called Cars and Civilization, in which I took the position that much of the civilization of the 20th century came from cars and oil. Some of your readers may enjoy that. It's on our website. Natural gas is really the dominant fuel now, even though people speak about other things, but it's really, it's the one that's still growing and gaining, even if people grumble about it a bit. That's mostly H and a bit of C. Looking forward, of course, then there's the question, on the one hand, you can generate electricity with nuclear, but you can also make hydrogen. And a lot of people are now interested in the hydrogen economy. But the question is, how do you make how do you store the electricity from nuclear or from solar and wind? Batteries are a lousy way to store energy, a subject you've probably spoken about with your readers. There are a lot of illusions and delusions and fake news, I'll say, about that. But hydrogen, in the long run, is a good way to store it. But there need to be more technical advances still. And hydrogen goes with fuel cells, of course. So you could imagine cars, either internal combustion engines running directly on hydrogen in future decades, or fuel cells rather than batteries powering the crude life, so to say.
His name is Jesse Ossobel. He's with the Rockefeller University. Peak human, that's what we're talking about today. We did not get to the eDNA. If we can maybe have him back down the line, I'd like to talk a little bit about that as well and some other energy-related research that he's done throughout the years. So I appreciate you coming on today. I'm taking a look at the clock. We only got a couple minutes left here. What type of plugging do you do for the Rockefeller Institute? Is there a website, just the regular website? Do you guys get donations? Take a minute or two to at least give yourself a plug, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, we've had a research group since 1993 called the Program for the Human Environment, and we're interested in a large, prosperous economy that spares lots of land and sea for nature and emits little or nothing harmful. And so we're, on the one hand, ecological. We're very interested in trees and fish, but we're also high tech and interested in motors and fuel cells and maglev trains and genomics. So we're a little different from many environmental, people tend to be, a lot of people who like nature don't like machines. And we sort of embrace both. But if you go to phe.rockefeller.edu or search on my name, you'll find our website. We have lots of material, lots of papers posted there. If anyone wants to send us a donation, naturally, we're happy about that. We're supported, as you'd expect, by some mix of grants, contracts from federal agencies, and some philanthropic donations. We're in that sense a typical university-based research group.
Well, I can tell you, as a former publisher, editor, writer, researcher, the whole deal. You're one of the best in the business, one of the fairest when it comes to actual non-fake news, if you will, real facts and that sort of thing. So you guys do a great work, and hopefully we can talk down the line.
Jason, it's been a pleasure.
Appreciate
it. Happy New Year.
Thank you. You too.